Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward and director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. I'm in for Diane Rehm today. She's on vacation, as are many, many others across the country, we hope, these days. And every day, millions of Americans take to the skies for pleasure, vacation, and for business. You know, flying was once reserved only for the well-to-do. It was a big deal. Today, just about everyone can afford to fly. The question is, do they like to fly today? That is a big question. So joining me to discuss the state of airline travel and where it's all headed, from Dallas, Texas, the Wall Street Journal's travel editor, Scott McCartney. From NPR studios in New York City, Susan Stellan. She writes frequently about travel for the New York Times. And in the studio with me, Nicholas Krolov. He's creator of On the Fly seminars and former Washington Times and Financial Times correspondent. Good day to you all.
Good morning.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Well, and you didn't have to fly to get here, so that's something. Nicholas, start us off on this, because you've traveled so much over the course of your life, and now you've made the travel business and this industry your profession. We are hearing about a passenger's bill of rights. I mean, we all know, anybody who flies knows what the hassles and the inconveniences are, from the security lines to the bumped flights to the incredible fees I'm waiting to pay extra to breathe when I get on a plane. What is this passenger's bill of rights, and what's the status of it?
Well, the bill of rights is something that came about a few months ago, and as a result of the treatment or the mistreatment many passengers have to experience when on the plane at an airport, when stuck on a tarmac waiting for 10, 12 hours on a plane. And so far, the reaction has been very mixed, because the industry has its own opinion, lawmakers have their own opinion, and customers have their own
opinion. Scott, what are some of the particulars of this thing?
Well, I think some of these things have already been pushed through by the Department of Transportation. The big change this summer is the tarmac delay rule. Airlines had several episodes of stranding people on board airplanes for 10 hours or more under horrid conditions, and the government finally took action, and that was one of the things that drove the discussion about whether Congress needed to pass a passenger rights bill. Now there's a three-hour limit. After that, airlines face huge fines, and so the industry has adjusted and reacted, and there are far fewer episodes of people being stuck on airplanes for extended periods.
Susan, would you say that's made a difference?
I think it has. I think there's also been other provisions of the Department of Transportation's regulations that haven't gotten as much attention, and one of those is just going to be coming online, which is that airlines will have to start publishing delay data. So when you purchase a flight, you'll be able to see, is this a flight that's chronically delayed?
What causes a flight to be chronically delayed? You know, because when you talk to the airline, well, it's the weather, it's mechanical, and yet you actually do see certain flights that are chronically delayed.
Right. There are some flights that are just plain losers, and it's.
I don't want to be on that plane. Thank you. What causes them to be losers?
I think there are two main reasons. One is there are scheduling problems. Flights can be chronically late because the crew flying that airplane may have a tough schedule and not get there in time, or the aircraft itself may not get there, or it may simply be scheduled to leave at the end of a long line of 45 other airplanes. So the takeoff slot or the landing slot essentially is bad. And the other thing is there are some flights that go out from hubs and come back to hubs and are on frequently traveled routes with lots of flights. And so they're very easy to cancel. And whenever you get bad weather and you have to thin out the schedule, you look for those kinds of flights, and they get canceled over and over again.
So, Susan, under this provision that you're talking about and that we're talking about here, you, the consumer, would actually be able to see these loser flights that Scott talks about, where you can see that this flight is 70% on time versus this one that's 82% on time or whatever.
Right, and I think what will be interesting to see is whether that affects if someone's willing to pay $20 extra for a flight that's 90% on time.
And another issue is that we're going to have a fee for flights that leave on time.
Well, it's voting with your pocketbook. And another issue is that one of the problems with the government's delay data and cancellation data is that it doesn't ever include international flights, and it doesn't include many regional flights. So for people like me, my family lives in northern Michigan. I have to take small planes up to Traverse City a lot, and many of those are not counted in the statistics. So I would love to know, is this flight 50% on time?
Nicholas, aren't there websites and other things out there now that provide this information, or some of it anyway?
There are websites like Flight Stats, for example, but the airline's own website is starting to do that too. And you can see when you click and do your search, you can see which flight was 83% on time or 60% on time. And fortunately, so far, the airline software and inventory management actually hasn't integrated the data on on-time arrivals with pricing, because if they do, what we'll see is what you suggested a few seconds ago, Frank, which was that maybe there is a way to charge more for flights that get out on time. But there are two other reasons that I thought I should mention in terms of the reasons for delays you asked about a minute ago. And one is the fleets of the U.S. carriers are very old. Really 15, 20, 25 years. Of course, mechanicals happen all the time. And the other thing is many airlines today schedule very short turnaround times. Sometimes you have literally 40 minutes or half an hour for a plane to come in, unload passengers and cargo, reload, reboard, and leave again. How is this going to happen?
No, and you know, I fly a lot. And if you fly a lot, by the way, we'd love you to join our conversation with a comment or a question for our panel. Our number is 1-800-433-8850, or you can email us a comment or a question at drshow@wamu.org. Scott, I fly a lot, and you can sort of see the train wreck or the plane wreck taking place, right? The crew is trying to make a connection in from someplace else, and one of those flights is delayed. If you're at a place like O'Hare or Dallas-Fort Worth, a gigantic queue of planes that are waiting to take off, and somebody's falling farther and farther behind, and this whole hub system, for it to work right, requires planes to arrive more or less on time so people can make their connections and the equipment and crews can be in place.
And what we've seen through the financial crisis that airlines have been through for the last decade is that they have tried to run their operations leaner and leaner. And that, I think, can easily increase delays. Right now we have a bit of a respite because capacity is down. They've taken a lot of flights out of schedule. Out of their schedules because of the recession. So the system is not as stressed. But in general, you can just see it deteriorate when they don't have the cleaners in place to clean the airplane, or the flight attendants are arriving late because they have a tougher schedule, or the aircraft is, there's not a spare aircraft to sub in when there is a mechanical problem. The whole push at airlines to be leaner, to be more efficient, means there's less slack in the system when things go wrong, and I have a lot of sympathy for airlines. They're doing this outdoors. They are subject to the vagaries of weather. They do have to deal with an inefficient government air traffic control system, and at the end of the day, it's a really tough business and very easy for things to go wrong.
And at the end of the day, if it's easy for things to go wrong, let's remember that we're defying gravity every time we get in an airplane and we take off, right? So, Susan,
right.
How about the cost cutting and some of these problems affecting safety? How worried are you about that?
Well, I think any time there are concerns about cost cutting, you find out after the fact that, that has caused a safety problem. I think one move in the right direction recently was Congress passing the extension of the FAA reauthorization, had a change where the number of flight hours for pilots was raised from 250 hours to, I think it was 1,500 hours. And that's in response to the crash, the Colgan Air crash, mm-hmm. which had raised a lot of concerns about regional pilots. And, where that gets into cost cutting is that, the major carriers have outsourced to regional carriers many of these smaller flights. And, that's an instance where, there was an effect of that.
So let me go around the horn here with each one of you and ask each one of you, you all travel a lot and you're all travel experts, what to you is the toughest or most unpleasant or most unfair part of airline travel today? Because we all have our private complaints or personal observations. Nicholas, what do you think is the toughest part of air travel today?
Two things for me. First has to do with the airlines. And of course, they've tried to cut capacity, save money, but they've resorted to some practices that are really, in my book, not very fair and almost cheating. And one of them is, for example, what is the difference between a nonstop and a direct flight? Most people don't know there is a difference, but there's a huge difference. A direct flight, actually, I call it fake direct flight because these are two separate flights. The only thing in common they have is the flight number. Everything else is different. It's like, exactly like a connection, but people don't know that, and many people book that flight thinking it's a nonstop. So that creates a lot of problems. On the other hand, though, there are many examples like this, but on the other hand, I think travelers also have some responsibility to get educated and to know more about the ticket they're buying, the fares they're buying, the booking class they're buying, and everything that comes with frequent flight programs and elite status and all that.
Scott, what's your beef?
I think it's the anxiety and uncertainty that airlines create. Pricing is the greatest example. I think some of the pricing practices of this industry are so unfriendly to consumers that they just drive people away. The fact that prices can change so often that you see a price and then you go to buy it and you can't find it.
Literally within minutes.
Literally within minutes. Several times a day, even faster when, you know, somebody else buys a seat on that airplane, so it changes the inventory and boom, the price changes.
Susan?
I think Scott had mentioned sort of the lack of slack in the system. So for people who have a canceled flight or they miss a connection. Right now what's happening with planes so full is that the ability to reaccommodate those passengers on other flights is just a huge issue. And there used to be a time when the airlines worked more together to take passengers from one carrier and put them on another when there were these partnerships. But right now I talk to people all the time who are told, we can get you out in 2 days.
And they can't. Even then. My favorite, paying $150 to change a ticket when it's a free ticket to begin with. We'll be back. More on the airline industry in just a moment. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno sitting in for Diane today. We're talking about your favorite topic and your favorite activity, which is airline travel in the United States. We're joined by Nicholas Krolov. He's a journalist, educator, speaker on global travel, diplomacy, international affairs. You do seminars on international travel. So you teach me how to travel. Is that what you're going
to
do?
Yes, how to travel cheaply, but comfortably and even luxuriously.
Luxuriously.
Yes.
Oh, well, I got to sign up for that. Susan Stellan, she writes frequently about travel for the New York Times. And Scott McCartney, he's travel editor and the middle seat columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Scott, that's my, I got to tell you, that's my, you know, I watch for that middle seat purgatory if I get that. And I hate to be rude about it, but what I look at more than the middle seat is the aisle and the window seat next to me if I get stuck in the middle. Because, you know, I guess I'm judged by the company I keep or something, but, you know.
Well, it's the battle for the shared elbow space and everything else. Is the guy next to you encroach on your limited 17-inch width? And, you know, the middle seat, there's a really fascinating psychology. Having an empty middle seat between you, research shows, greatly enhances the flight experience. The service was better, the flight was more on time, you know, everything is better about the experience if the middle seat beside you is empty. If you end up in the middle seat, it's really quite an unpleasant experience, particularly as legroom has diminished and airlines have squeezed more and more seats onto the same airplane. And I think the middle seat has become more of a phenomenon because we have seen this capacity reduction, and yet travel has increased. And the result is planes are really full. I mean, 85-90% full this summer on average, which means, most every flight, there's not an empty seat. A few flights in oddball hours to oddball destinations will have empty seats.
So, Susan, why aren't the airlines making money then?
Well, if I had that answer, I'd be running one probably. Well, the second quarter actually was a good quarter for the airline industry. I think all but American Airlines declared profits. So, that's a shift. And then there are carriers who have been consistently profitable. Southwest is kind of the notable example.
And we'll talk about Southwest in a minute because that is a sort of breed apart. Nicholas?
I must say I don't have too much sympathy for many of the people who end up in the middle seats. I'll tell you why. Because people are not used to getting seat assignments as soon as they buy their ticket. They wait until check-in. Well, you can get a seat 10, 11 months out. So why do you wait until the airport? You can check in online the day before at home. So many, now, if you are rerouted for some reason and there is no other seat, then, of course, I have great sympathy for you. But if you bought your ticket 6 months ago and you didn't bother to look at the seat map and choose a seat, then...
Yeah, well, lots of people don't buy their tickets 6 months in advance.
I know, but many do. Many do.
Comment from Tourist 1234 in an email that we've got here. The airlines should charge a fee for any carry-on bigger than a standard purse or briefcase. Tourist writes they then need to make the first bag checked free. This would give passengers incentive to check a bag instead of trying to lug an overpacked large bag onto the plane. We've all watched that. Look, I have the Rolly, right? It comes in, but it's supposedly regulation size. Scott, what do you think about that? Charging more or differently for bags? I mean, this whole fee structure is mystifying from one airline to the next, too.
Well, that's essentially what Spirit Airlines is doing now, and they've just been vilified for charging carry-on bag fee. Spirit has a particular problem. They don't have enough overhead bins for all the seats that they put on an airplane. So there are lots of people on each flight left without any overhead bin space. So what they did was impose a carry-on bag fee and make it more expensive than the checked bag fee as a way to sort of incentivize people to check bags. When airlines started imposing the checked bag fee, it really did encourage people to carry more stuff into the cabin to avoid fees. And so you have this real logjam that can be messy.
Susan?
I actually flew Spirit just before the carry-on charges went into effect. It was my first Spirit flight, and, the boarding process was painfully slow, and just before me, the agent checking everybody in started grabbing our rolling bags and checking them and said, all the bins are full. Well, then I got on the plane, and the two bins above my seat and many others throughout the plane were entirely empty. So I think there's also a gap between what people understand the policy to be and when they get on, sort of the frustration that you're treated, as if, people can compare it to cattle. But, it's just the lack of customer service in a situation
like that. So what do you do in a situation like that? I mean, let's take this another step, all right? If you're a customer and you go to a store and you're treated rudely, you complain to the manager. Maybe something happens, maybe doesn't, or it doesn't, or you don't buy that product again. You have some sense of empowerment or some sense of recourse as a customer. You can write the letter. I know lots of people who do it to the airline thinking that you're going to get a free trip in return if you complain. And it almost never works that way, and there's no sense of resolution. Does this passenger's bill of rights or anything else out there give passengers more leverage? Nicholas, you do seminars about this. What would you tell me if I asked that in class?
Yes, that's right, Frank. And by the way, ontheflyseminars.com. I think people should really look into, for example, how they can have these baggage fees waived, because it's not that difficult. And you, Frank, as a traveler who has elite status, even though it may not be the highest, you actually get the first two bags waived even domestically.
But that's if you're already in a frequent flyer program.
That's
and you've
right.
achieved a certain number of miles.
That's right.
But if you're not at that status, you're on your own.
But let me tell you, it's become really easy to achieve that status.
So wait. But if you don't have that, let's talk mm-hmm. for people
sure.
for a moment about people who don't have that status. Can they get baggage fees waived?
You have to have elite status, so you have to travel with someone who does have that status.
Okay,
these are the ways to waive the baggage
fees. That means so many miles over the course of a year?
Well, not that many. If you are a member of a U.S. program, it's 25,000 for the first level. But there are now global airline alliances. There are three of them around the world, and they have many, many members. If you are if you travel on United, Continental, US Airways, this is the Star Alliance. There are 28 members. There is a new member. The newest member of the Star Alliance is the Greek airline Aegean. And to achieve the first silver level on Aegean, you only need to fly 4,000 miles. That's it.
Scott, we're getting some emails from people who are saying, thank you for talking about the airline industry, but my beef is with the TSA and the security people. They're rude and they touch me where I don't want to be touched, and they go through things arbitrarily. What's your take on that? We've seen some efforts to, they're actually occasionally anyway, wishing you a nice flight now. Maybe that's an effort to be nicer or smile or
well,
something.
There's been some effort, but it's a very difficult management challenge. They've hired all kinds of people from all kinds of walks of life, and I don't think, you know, TSA rude employees and harassing, it's a real serious problem. It became more of a problem lately, I think, with the full body imaging scanners. People have travelers have reacted negatively to how TSA has sort of forced them into that or treated them if they decline the full body scan, and then they get a kind of aggressive full body pat down and sometimes even a lecture about their patriotism. And this has happened over and over. We've seen TSA be more aggressive about trying to find people smuggling drugs and things like that, and gotten in trouble with federal judges about how far searches have gone. It's a difficult problem. They want to keep everybody safe. That's incredibly important, as we've seen. But the lack of customer service at the TSA checkpoint and the way, you know, frequent travelers and perfectly upstanding law-abiding citizens who, you know, may even have security clearances and things get treated with really horrible behavior is a real detriment to the travel industry.
To join our conversation, call us at 1-800-433-8850, or you can email us at drshow@wamu.org. I want to go to the phones now for our call from Mark, who joins us from Bedford, Texas. Hi, Mark.
Hello, and thanks for having such a great topic. I have to tell you that being in the industry, it's what we do every day, and you just see it as a passenger. Living it is degrees worth.
So you're in the industry. What do you do?
Well, I'm actually a pilot for one of the carriers just recently mentioned, the one that somehow managed to lose money, amazingly. But as we found out, it's mostly all GAAP certified, but Enron-esque levels of accounting. That's why we're losing money.
Oh, that's nice to know.
it all has to do with negotiations and contracts. I mean, we're making 1993 wages, to give you an FYI.
They would say that they're probably would say they're paying too much for fuel and too much for labor costs.
Exactly. And I do want to ask the question, I guess, of the guests is, and given the importance of the industry for the infrastructure of our country, is there any thought that perhaps there might be some level of re-regulation that might get us to a more appropriate situation, because the customer satisfaction levels are so low, with the exception, of course, of Southwest, that I'm wondering, is it a race to the bottom, or is there some solution short of the deregulation status that we have now that would get us to a place where the passengers are happy and the employees are happier, or maybe just clone that other airline that seems to be doing so well between everybody, the stockholders, their customers, and, of course, the employees that work there. In the industry, it's so hard to see the solution, but we're wondering if perhaps one of your guests, being from outside the industry, might have some input for the rest of us.
Mark, thanks very much for your question. Very thoughtful question. Who wants to take a shot at that? Any chance of re-regulation of the industry, or is that the way to go? Scott, you want to start?
Well, it comes up from time to time, certainly among labor groups, among some in Congress. I wrote a story recently about the regulated days, in part because there were people in Washington who were saying, hey, we need to re-regulate this. I think a couple thoughts. First, there's a lot of nostalgia involved. The regulated days were not nearly as good as people think they were. It was incredibly expensive to fly. Customer service was not always as great as people remembered. And you know, the industry was not as safe. In some ways, it was more difficult to get where you want to go.
Well, you had to work through a travel agent. There was a lot of rigmarole.
Yeah,
it was not very democratic.
So as the reality is, people get what they want in this business, which is really affordable air travel. We want to go, and we want cheap tickets, and that's what we're getting. And so I don't think there's any chance that that the industry would be regulated again. And I also don't think you can really regulate good customer service. You know, the airlines that are known for the best customer service are essentially the ones that have sprung up after the industry was deregulated. So JetBlue or Southwest or AirTran. I don't think regulation is going to get you good customer service. I think that's a management problem that airlines have to work through.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Sharon from Orlando, Florida, you're with us and on the air now. Thanks for calling and waiting.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I'm getting ready to fly, and it's a flight that I take regularly. It's a major airline. I don't know if I can say the name, but I was shocked to learn that when I booked my ticket, I was not allowed to select my seat until 24 hours before departure. In the past, yes, I could pick my seat. They don't allow it. I went to their website. I booked flights there many times, and no longer can you pick your seat.
Where was this flight from and to?
Orlando to Cleveland, which is a secondary hub of Continental.
And has this happened to you before, or was this the first?
No.
And you can't pick your seat, but you can pick it online, but not until 24 hours before flight time.
That's a recent change, mm-hmm. along with some other crazy pricing and weird things that are happening.
Fees and things like that.
Well, it bothers me, yeah. I picked a flight that was $100 less by changing my departure by one date. And the other thing is that when I booked it, there was a $30 increase. I guess all the fees and what they quote you online is not what you actually end up paying.
Well, hopefully they're not going to charge you the remaining $70 when you book your seat for a fee to get a seat. But, Susan, how common is this that you can't get a seat until 24 hours before flight time, as in this case?
Well, Spirit is one of the airlines that's been pretty upfront about the fact that if you want to choose a seat, you have to pay for that seat. And they did recently redesign their website so that it's clearer as you're going through the ticketing process that, you know, you go through a page that says select a seat and you see how much each seat is, and the same thing for their baggage policies now. But the seat fees have kind of crept in, and I think what frustrates people is the thing that happened to Sharon is finding out after the fact that, you know, you've booked something and these websites aren't as clear as some of the airlines would like to think they are. So it's the surprises at the end that I think bother people more than, you know, the seat fees can range from an extra $5 to $25 or maybe even higher depending on what seat you choose. But, you know, the problem for a lot of people right now is not knowing this up front.
Courtney joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Courtney.
Hi.
Go ahead with your question.
Well, I had a really horrible experience with Delta, and I'm just wondering, and I had it going to and from. I was supposed to go to Raleigh, North Carolina, ended up rerouting myself to Charlotte because, like you guys said, they couldn't get me out until 2 days later because there were 200 other people that had to be rebooked, and by the time I could get through on the 1-800 helpline or stand in, you know, the line at the desk or whatever, all the other flights had been full. And I feel like Delta and Northwest used to be such good airlines because that's what I've flown my whole life. And I feel now that they've merged, it's just gone to hell, really.
Had there been some terrible weather problem or something that all these people were being rebooked?
It was everything. First, they were delayed. The flight coming in was delayed, and then that put us behind because we missed our slot to get out. And then our flight crew, because of the delay, had met there some regulation with, like, a flight crew can only work so many hours. And by the time we got to our destination, it would have been over their limit. So we had to wait for a new flight crew, and then we were on the tarmac, and then they're like, oh, we have to go back because you've been on the plane for too long. I mean, we were boarded and unboarded three times before they canceled the flight.
The airline airport nightmare makes me think of, what was it, Terminal, was that? That was the movie where Tom Hanks is stranded for days. Nicholas, what does someone like Courtney do in a situation like this? How often does that sort of thing happen?
It happens all the time, many, many times, every hour, even every minute, somewhere in the world, somewhere in the country. And what it's come to is the airlines try to take care of their most loyal customers. In other words, again, I go back to the elite status issue, but that's where you've got the dedicated elite lines and you don't have to wait that long. I've called from the plane, a plane that's being delayed, then I see I'll miss a connection. I call and within a couple of minutes, I'm rebooked on a different flight. And the rest of the plane is wondering how for heaven's sake, I got this so quickly. And I understand that not everybody can get elite status, but I would say to people, even if you fly 2-3 times a year, there are ways to get to that first elite level, and believe me, it makes a big difference.
And what's the fastest way to get to the elite level?
The fastest way to get to the elite level, as I said earlier, Star Alliance, Aegean Airways of Greece, only 4,000 miles to get to the elite level. Now you get 1,000 miles just for signing up, so 3,000 miles for elite status.
More on the airline industry and where it's going or not going when we come back. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane, who's on vacation.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Eich takes us back to the Roaring Twenties in Chicago, when cops and judges were on the take, bootleggers were mowing each other down, and Al Capone bragged to reporters about his underworld clout. He made his reputation the day he approached a rival in broad daylight.
Says hello, puts the gun to his cheek, fires 6 times, and holds him on the bar stool as he keeps firing.
What you didn't know about Al Capone. Join us.
Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. We're talking about airline travel and the civility, or lack of it, in the air with Nicholas Krolov. He's a journalist, educator, and speaker on global travel with Susan Still, and she writes frequently about travel for the New York Times. She also is author of a book, How to Travel Practically Anywhere, and Scott McCartney, travel editor and the Middle Seat columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Lots of emails. I think we've touched a nerve here. Here's one. This is a really interesting one from Ivan, who says, please advise your listeners to clear their browsers, cookies, and cache each and every time they check a flight. The airlines raise ticket prices if your browser reports you've made repeated inquiries for the same product, i.e. a given flight. Anybody know anything about that? Scott? That one?
Well, it's an issue in the industry. It's something that people suggest. I don't think it's done. I think what happens is prices do go up, as we talked about earlier. I think inventory changes. Airlines do raise prices. We're in an environment because of the tight capacity where prices have gone up and gone up quickly. Fares were up 18% in June and similar price increase levels in July. For an airline to just keep raising the price because you make a search inquiry, that doesn't really make sense. It's a very competitive business. You can certainly shop other airlines easily. There are lots of comparison websites. And so for one airline to say, hey, you're interested in going to Detroit, and I know that, and so I'm just going to keep raising the price to Detroit, well, then they're going to lose the sale to somebody else.
Susan, what about those comparison websites? You know, they can do some shopping around, comparative shopping for you. There are so many of them. There's Orbitz and Travelocity and Kayak and all these different things. Good way to go?
Well, one interesting, in answering Ivan's question, one interesting theory that I'd read about that is that when you do a search on some of these sites, they don't necessarily query the airline databases or the central ticketing database every time some customer is just browsing and searching for flights. So the price that you may be getting may not be the most up-to-the-minute, up-to-the-second price. It's not until you get through the ticketing queue that they actually query that database to confirm that's still the price, because they pay for that. And, you know, this was something I read that would provide an explanation that I thought was interesting.
Here's one from Jill, who writes, my biggest complaint is that I feel the airlines are not honest with me when there are delays. Nicholas, are they dishonest when there are delays?
I think they end up being quite that. And sometimes they mean well. In other words, they know a plane is coming in late from Munich, for example, and that plane is supposed to go to Denver. The plane is an hour and a half, 2 hours late. But they're hoping, sometimes not only for the best, but they're hoping against hope that that plane will make time in the air. And it just doesn't happen. And yes, sometimes you can learn more online about your flight than at the gate.
There have been a lot of references in the conversation so far today, and we've got several more in the emails here, to Southwest and Southwest's model. So, and Scott, I want to start with you, if I can, on this. Just a couple of things, because I travel Southwest, so I'm familiar with it. A, there's not a baggage fee for that first bag or for the carry-on. Most importantly, there's no seat assignment. You get that at the point within 24 hours that you go online and get your ticket. So it's a first-come, first-served kind of thing, and then you stand in the line accordingly. Even more importantly, if you change your flight, there's no charge. Your credit goes into an account and is held under that confirmation number, and you can go back and use that credit and apply it to future travel. It seems very clean and very efficient. It has none of the frills that the old legacy airlines used to have. People seem very happy with it. Is that a model that other airlines are going to adapt more and more? Might there be a sort of Southwest light at the end of the tunnel with other carriers?
Well, you know, Southwest has been around for more than 30 years, and the model is essentially the same. And they've been successful for all of that time, profitable, I think, all but 1 year. And, you know, the model has been there for other carriers to adopt. They have adopted some things that that Southwest has found successful. But as you note, they still are unique. I think, you know, the bottom line is Southwest makes it easy to use their product. And it just is mind-boggling to me that other airlines don't make more effort to make it easier to use their product. Change fees and things like that are great examples of, just the notion that you're going to punish your customers is really remarkable, and Southwest takes the other attitude. An interesting development under the new CEO at Southwest is that they're adopting some policies of that are somewhat similar to other airlines.
Like what?
You mentioned 24 hours to get your seat assignment. Well, you can buy that seat assignment in advance now.
For 20 bucks or something.
You can buy your way to the front of the line. There's essentially an elite level in their frequent flyer program where you always get first numbers in line, and that gets you extra legroom because you can go straight to the exit.
We should also point out that I think at many airports it also allows you into that elite security line. So you can get to the front of that line faster.
And Southwest used to be completely egalitarian. Everybody was the same. And now they do have some different classes of customers.
All right, let's go to
David.
I
actually paid that fee.
Yeah, and?
And when I flew at $10, they call it early bird boarding. I thought I'd try it out when I was flying from Los Angeles to Oakland. And in the end, it wasn't a very full plane, but I think I was 10th or 15th in line. And to me, it was worth it.
You see, there's something actually sort of democratic about even that, because you don't have to go through all kinds of hoops to be in that elite status. You know, and anybody can buy their way into it. To the phones and David.
Well, it's affordable.
Yeah. David, Reston, Virginia. Hi, David.
Hey, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an airline pilot, regional airline pilot, working for a Delta carrier. And I just want to put some numbers on what people are paid at the regional airlines. And just as an aside, a regional airline is a misnomer. I routinely fly from Dallas to Boston in an 80-seat jet. It's a very big region. I am paid $23,000 a year. That's gross. And our flight attendants in my company start at $18,000, and that's a 1 and an 8. And top out at 23, coincidentally.
How much are you working for that money? Because that's you know, interns are paid more than that in some places.
I'm working a maximum of 100 hours a month. That's a federal law. My duty day is 14 hours. That's a federal law. My performance is not related to how much I get paid because I'm at the tippy tip of this airplane, and landing it safely is an exercise in self-survival, as well as taking care of the passengers. But my point is, and by the way, the gate agents and baggage handlers are usually paid right around minimum wage. So my point is that the personnel costs are extraordinarily low and can't be made much lower. A law just passed that's going to mandate 1,500 hours for new commercial pilots, which is going to mean that for a pilot to be able to apply for a $23,000 job, somebody is going to have to spend about $210,000 to get those qualification hours.
David, may I just ask you, do you have another job on the side? I mean, $23,000 isn't going to get you very far in this economy.
I'm so happy you asked that question. Most pilots have a side business of some sort. I happen to be retired military, so I have something to fall back on. I have good health care. I'm very fortunate, but my roommates and my crash pad make $22,000 a month. They can't buy anything or really live effectively on that.
All right, David, thanks very much. Let's discuss this for a little bit. Scott?
You know, the other thing that regional airline pilots have historically taken those jobs at very low levels of pay for two reasons. One is you also get paid in jet time hours. Now, if you're a retired military pilot, that may not be as important to somebody who's come up through the civilian ranks. But getting the hours in that jet allows you to move up to higher paying jobs. And pilots have essentially structured the industry through the seniority system to start at low pay and move up to big pay. You know, what used to be $400,000 for flying a 747 to Japan every now and then by the time you finish your career. That dynamic has changed considerably. The $400,000 jobs have disappeared. People are flying more. There's not the big payday at the end of the rainbow. And certainly the starting pay has gone down.
Scott, do you worry about
the really low levels?
Do you worry about the qualifications and the motivations and the capabilities of someone who's flying at this level of pay?
Well, I think requiring a larger number of flight hours for entry level jobs is a good thing.
Okay.
I'm a private pilot. I have 700 hours. The notion that they'd put me in the right seat of a regional jet is frightening to me.
Susan, what about we're asked this question comes into us. What about the recent Delta Northwest merger, coming United Continental merger, and impact that's going to have on this entire conversation?
Well, I think it's partly, it depends on what route you're flying. You know, I think a lot of the discussions about both of those mergers, you know, focus on, you know, the fact that there are choices for people. But when you're heading to a smaller city, you know, Traverse City is one I go to frequently, so there are just a handful of choices. And I think that's the issue is, you know, what is this going to mean for the hub and spoke system, and also kind of what are their ways to foster more competition so we can start seeing more airlines like Southwest?
Nicholas, you worried about these mergers, or is there any way that these mergers can actually work for consumers?
I think in both ways, actually. I'm worried because there are issues, there are labor issues, for example, the gentleman just talked about salaries. Look at some of the executive compensation at those, the big airlines. He works for a regional carrier, that's different. He gets paid not by Delta, but by his own carrier. But have a look at the severance pay that some executives are getting from those mergers, the ones who are leaving. They're just, to me, really, really just... Yeah, indecent.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join the conversation in our minutes remaining, call us at 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. A lot of our emails, folks, have to do with security and TSA and what you go through. And Susan, since you've written How to Travel Practically Anywhere, your book, maybe you can talk a little bit about this. I watch people going through the security, and it seems that many of them make their own lives more complicated and more cumbersome with what they're wearing and what they're carrying. And, you know, there's even this, it's called a butterfly bag that you can put your computer in so that you can zip it open and you don't actually have to take your computer out. It just saves a little bit of time. Hints?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, you see people who are just examples of, you know, what was that person thinking when they got dressed this morning in the pants that have all the metal grommets on it and layers of jewelry and things like that. But then, you know, there are times where I do the same thing where I grab a belt that maybe isn't, you know, is one I need to take off, so that slows things down. You know, hints, I'm not sure. The TSA tried this system where you were supposed to be guided into a line for expert travelers, frequent travelers, and then families. And the last time I flew out of LaGuardia, I was steered into expert, and the person who I just sort of kept track, who went into the line at the same time as me and leisure travelers, kind of beat me through by 10 minutes, and then there was a child and a stroller, and we tied at the end. So, you know, but that took half an hour to get through. So my best advice is, you know, assume the worst and get to the airport very early, because if you miss your flight, you know,
all right, so Scott,
you're gonna get rebooked.
What do you have any tips for people? I mean, wear loafers.
Well, wear loafers, sure. I think for security, you have to have a routine. Do everything the same way. You know, I worry about people losing their driver's license, for example, when they have to take it out to show the agent. Make sure you put it away, or you put it in the same pocket every time. Put the boarding pass in the same pocket every time. You know when you get up there, okay, where's my baggie with my liquids and where's my laptop? And just go through it with the routine. It makes it much easier for you and quicker for everyone else.
An email from Nisha, who observes that when a flight is canceled or weather creates a delay, people are being asked to check online or call the airline, but she has a real problem with that because sometimes the online information is lagging. Nicholas, is that a problem? How do you get around that? What's the best way to get real-time information?
Well, if you're on a plane, unless you've got an iPhone or BlackBerry, you really can't do much. And because there's no Wi-Fi if you want to use a computer. So at that point, your best bet is to call on the phone even before you get on the plane. Don't line up behind 200 people at a counter, because first of all, it'll take forever to get to the counter. Yeah, yeah. And by the time you get there, your choices will be almost non-existent. So I'll still try to get through. Now, the biggest problem is you get through and you get someone in India. That, I mean, to me, that is just the most frustrating thing. And thankfully, for elite passengers, you're assured that you're an agent in the United States. But if you get someone in India who needs 20 minutes to understand what exactly you're experiencing, by then you're just beside yourself.
Let me ask each of you as we wrap up the conversation here to look ahead and talk a bit about where you see the industry going and what you think passengers, consumers should be doing to anticipate some of these changes or just dealing with the present. Sort of a little moment to summarize. Scott, you want to start us off?
Well, I think we will have fewer airlines in the future. I thought we have three big international airlines and three big discount value carriers, and that'll provide good competition. I have some hope that the industry will be more stable financially, and that will allow airlines to invest in new planes and improve customer service, better labor relations, and really make the industry better.
Susan Stellan.
I think a lot more people are starting to rethink their options. You know, I wrote recently about some of the newer bus companies, particularly in the Northeast and out of Chicago. And, you know, when you can get between Boston and New York or New York and D.C. for less than $25, you know, people are making those comparisons. And I think if we see things like that spread or the train as an option, I just did a long driving trip and, you know, it was much more pleasant than flying.
Nicholas?
I think the way that things are going, people will have to really think strategically and plan before they travel. Just on the whim will be very difficult to manage and to get a good seat and to have a good experience. So if you can think a few weeks out, if you can think about more than one trip at a time, that'll help. And again, I repeat this, if you can get to the lowest elite level on an airline, please do. That'll help a lot.
Take nothing for granted and give yourself lots and lots of time. You sort of do best if you put yourself in another zone and say, I'm just traveling and I'm going to do the best I can. Well, thanks to our panel today for talking about air travel in America, where it's going and where it's been. And good luck if you're about to take a flight someplace. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Have a great day.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.